This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, we are airing a candidate conversation with the major party nominees running to represent Utah's 2nd U.S. Congressional District, Democratic challenger Cale Weston and Republican incumbent Representative Chris Stewart. Today's conversation is part of Informed Decisions 2020, a collaboration between the Hinckley Institute of Politics and the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute. This series is meant to educate Utah voters and familiarize them with candidates in key races throughout the state. Jason Perry, director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics, moderates today's conversation between Democrat Cale Weston and Republican Representative Chris Stewart. They discuss issues facing the state and how they would contribute to Congress on the national level. This forum was recorded on September 18, 2020. Here's your moderator, Director Jason Perry.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Informed Decisions 2020, the first of our three candidate conversation forums. My name is Jason Perry. I'm the director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics. Every major election cycle, we team up with the Gardner Policy Institute to talk to the candidates for office, to talk about the issues that matter to them, the positions they're going to take, and why they decided to run for office. The whole goal of these conversations is to let you, the voter, get to know these candidates better. We are so happy to have with us today Mr. Cale Weston, the Democratic candidate for the 2nd Congressional District. This will be a 30-minute conversation. Now, Mr. Weston, we tried this last week. Audio-visual technicalities there we needed to work through, but it's so important that everyone has a chance to get to know you and to hear your answers. So even though we're not doing this exactly in front of the virtual live audience, we have the questions from them. We're going to go through these questions because it's important that we have a chance to get to know you. So thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to do round two. We appreciate it.
So glad to have you. Let's just jump right in, because I'd like to spend some time with our voters having a chance to get to know you. You have had such an interesting career, and the path here I'd like to talk about for a moment, but over 10 years with the State Department, 7 years in Iraq and Afghanistan. Please talk about that.
Sure. What do you do after 7 consecutive years and 2 wars? I guess you go to the wilderness, the desert, Congress. I've spent so much time, what I believe to be probably the greatest honor I've had, which is representing our country officially. And that's especially hard when our country has been at war for the last 2 decades. So my career in government as a civilian started in a very different place than where I ended up. But I had the great privilege of working very closely with our military. I was a political official in Fallujah, for example, where we had to, during and after the biggest battle of the Iraq war, rebuild the city. So from there, I went over to Afghanistan and finally got to a part of the world that had ties to 9/11. But I've done a lot of hard things, I think, in my former career. I don't think running for Congress is going to be harder than that, but I think it's one of the most important things I can do. And I think what my time, especially in Iraq, taught me is that when policy fails or we have bad policy, the cost is lives. And I think we're seeing that with COVID today. So I'm very serious about if someone wants to hire me to be in government, my job is to make sure the policy matches families that have real concerns about healthcare, are worried about grandparents who may get COVID, and just a country that's functioning. And right now, we're not functioning. So that's one of the big reasons why I'm running.
I want to get into a couple of those great issues that you mentioned. But if you don't mind, I'd just like to take a second about this experience. When I've talked to people who have been associated with war in other parts of the world, it sort of changes your worldview. It gives you a sense of what it means to be an American, to be in these parts of places, and really a view of war that sometimes gives you a perspective that changes how you might govern. Maybe just a minute on that, because I know that it has an impact, and you've even had a chance to write about that.
I did, and thank you. Yeah, when you're serving your country, whether military or civilian like me, it really refocuses you on what matters and the ties that bind us as Americans. And I think that for me, leaving war, where I saw a lot of the human cost of war, a lot of my Iraqi friends were killed and hurt, a lot of my Afghan friends were killed and hurt, a lot of my Marine and soldier and other service member friends were killed and hurt. It, I think, made me more serious about why it is that we should try and get along. And there are people, I think, who come back from war with challenges, but I think there's some positive that can come out of it, which is I think it allows you to sweat only on the big stuff, and most of life is not the big stuff. Unfortunately, I think 2020 and where we are as a country and in our district and state, it is the big stuff. And I think that I'm better prepared to ask for people's votes based on those hard years overseas.
Mm-hmm. And you did write a book about those hard years overseas, which I look forward to reading. But also, I'm kind of curious, since you're an author, is there a book you're hoping to write?
There is. You're right. The book I had to write is a 600-page nonfiction war book. That's the due diligence of, you know, telling the stories about Iraqis and Afghans and service members that I believed I owed to them, having spent as much time working with them. The next book I want to write is actually on the whole subject of moral courage. My time in the wars, I saw a lot of physical courage, a lot of bravery. I saw a lot of medals being awarded for that. The State Department awarded me a medal for heroism, which I usually don't mention, but I'm very interested in when people stand up and do the right thing. And I'll credit our junior senator, Mitt Romney, for doing that. I think he demonstrated the topic I want to write about, which is what I call the courage of one. I think it's the hardest courage of all. And that's what we need more of in Washington, is people who are putting country over party. And that's a big theme of our campaign.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe if I can take that thread for a moment, because it's something I've been observing in politics too, it seems to be not just the traditional kind of politics, but it seems like almost every single aspect of our lives is requiring someone to put down a political flag, from the mask wearing to the gatherings to the public schools to what's happening in Washington, D.C. What do you see happening there, and how are you going to engage with that?
It is, masks should not be political. Masks are in everyone's interest. It's showing that you care about your neighbor. I think if you get people in government who are willing to say, what's the public good? In my view, good governing is about trying to achieve the public good. And how you get there is the debate, and it's an important debate, and there may be different ideas about how to achieve the public good. But I also would argue that people are making choices to be divided. That's not how I operate. I'm a bridge builder by nature, and I think it's a big difference between me and Mr. Stewart. I think he looks for division. I look for unity. And that's my career. If I had to step into a room full of former Taliban fighters and try and have them put down their weapons so they wouldn't shoot our troops, that's a pretty good experience to bring to Washington. You know, that experience over there will stay with me my whole life. And when you've been shot at, and I had Taliban machine gun bullets hit 3 or 4 feet to my left on a mud wall, I think it refocused me on what it means to be an American, what values you stand for, and what you're prepared to fight for and stand up for. And I don't care if someone's a Republican, Libertarian, or Independent, but if we can agree on values and finding solutions to common problems, then I think, to your question, we depoliticize issues that should be for the benefit of Utahns, whichever part of the state they live in, and really for all Americans. And I think that's generally been where we've tried to be as a country. Unfortunately, in 2020, and one of the reasons why I'm running is I think we're at DEFCON 1. I think we're at a point now where we've got to find places to come together, and it's a choice. And I think if our politicians are choosing to divide us, as some are, we need to hold them accountable, and basically we need to give them another job. We need to fire them.
Well, let's talk about that job of running for office. I have a chance to talk with a lot of people who have decided to run for office, and that is not an easy decision. You're putting yourself out there, you, your family, lots of others. Tell us why, the voter, why did you decide to do this now?
I'll quote a friend of mine who's overseas who was telling me what they thought. He said, Cale, the problem is you're in love with your country. You can't let it go. And I thought that was a pretty good way of putting what would have been the easier thing. It would have been easier to write another book. I have a great editor, a great publisher. It would have been easier to teach. I love teaching. But I think for all of us, whether you're a candidate or just a concerned citizen, by November 2nd, the night before the election, I think we all want to be in a place where we've done what we should do, which is find ways to make 2021 a better year than 2020. The second part of that is, and I am blunt, is if I wasn't as concerned about what Donald Trump and Chris Stewart represent, I wouldn't be in this race. I believe it's a clear choice. I believe this is not a decision of a few degrees difference. I am a uniter. I want to bring people together. I'm a problem solver, and I've got a long track record in government to prove that. I believe, unfortunately, Mr. Stewart has made decisions to play politics and to be a divider. I can talk in more detail about some policy areas where I think that's especially clear. And I think the most important one for voters who may be listening is healthcare. I want to help make sure that people have access to affordable healthcare. He has voted over 40 times to take away the Affordable Care Act. That's factual. It's a record based on the voting pattern. And I think that those are issues that we need to talk about as two campaigns seeking, you know, your votes.
Let's get into a couple of those. If you, those issues that you might be advocating if you are elected, what are maybe one or two of the first pieces of legislation that you would like to try to work on?
Well, I led with healthcare, and I'll circle back to that. And I am on the individual market in the Affordable Care Act, so I speak from experience. I had a cushy six-figure job in the State Department, and when I became a teacher and a writer, I've now lived what I think a lot of people in the second congressional district are living, which is a very uncertain healthcare environment. I've got another personal issue, downwinders. My dad is a downwinder. I would be on the side of Ben McAdams when it comes to nuclear testing, which Mr. Stewart and the administration seem to want to start again. I would protect the post office. He skipped a vote, a very important vote, and hasn't explained why he skipped that vote. I don't believe you go to Washington to hide from roll call. I would also, I think, want to work on lands issues. I think my experience bridging between former Al-Qaeda guys in Fallujah and Taliban, former Taliban fighters in Host Province, makes me a good mediator. I've been down to Escalante and Garfield County, and I've had conversations with not just the county commissioners, but with the environmentalists and the ranchers and the former loggers. And those are areas, again, where in CD2, because it's a big gerrymandered district, I'm always looking for the common ground. So if I get asked about guns in rural Utah or in the middle of the avenues in Salt Lake City, I'm fine answering a question about how our country, I think, needs to come to a different place on the balance there. But I usually want to then shift to, hey, are you worried about going bankrupt over unexpected healthcare bills? If your member of your family has a pre-existing condition, how certain are you that pre-existing condition might not bankrupt you? And that's, again, an issue that translates into Tooele County, Iron County, Washington County, Davis County, Salt Lake County. So those are a few of the issues. And then I think politics at its best is about optimism and positive. It's building things. It's not tearing things down. And I think that in 2021, there's a lot of repair and rebuilding that we need to start. That's true internationally as well as at home.
When you start thinking about those pieces of legislation and the rebuilding that will be required, it's going to require you, if elected, to reach across the aisle to work with our own delegation here from the state of Utah. Talk about your thoughts about how you will approach those relationships.
Well, I think it starts with listening. I think it starts with understanding where someone's coming from. I don't want to doubt people's motives. I do look accurately and hard at what the pattern of votes say about someone. But I know I live in a state that has an overwhelming Republican delegation. It didn't used to be that way. But one of the reasons why I'm running is I think it's a good time to be a Democrat. I think when we give people choices in Utah and you trust the voter, they'll usually come down pretty reasonably on issues that are important to every family in Utah. So whether it's, you know, the senators or the members of Congress I would be working with, I think I'm pretty easy to deal with, and I'm very straightforward and upfront. And I try to be respectful. I don't like the nasty side and the negative side of what's like poison in the system right now. Because, you know, guess who pays the biggest price when we're playing games with people's lives like COVID? It's our neighbors. So two themes that we led off with were country over party, representing our country officially I think is good experience to say, I hope I'm prepared to represent a district of 700,000 people. But the other thing gets, I think, to your question, Jason, which is, I said in December of last year, there are ways to be better neighbors to each other. That became a very in thing to say when COVID hit. But I believe that being good neighbors and even better neighbors takes a choice on both sides. And to the credit of our Utah model, we're pretty good at that. And I think we could take some of that to Washington and say, we may disagree on some things, but we're not going to tear each other up over it.
Let's talk about that district. You say the 700,000 people who are in your district. What's interesting about the way these lines drawn is you will represent some pretty rural parts of the state, pretty and rural parts of the state, but also some of the more populated parts of Utah. Tell us how you feel about the wisdom of those being part of your portfolio and how you will bring those two very different perspectives together.
Yeah, great question. And I'm on the record. I've written a lot about this. I love the boundaries of CD2. Partly it's just being practical. I'm running a district that has lines drawn. It's been drawn for a decade and they'll be redrawn here in the next year. But I do believe that as someone seeking to represent a complicated, politically diverse district, I would be a better representative if I'm running in a rural and an urban district. I don't want to be running in just a blue bubble in Salt Lake City. I also wouldn't want to be just running where my parents grew up and where I spent a lot of time as a kid, which is in rural Beaver County, where my uncle, who went to Vietnam, returned and became a popular Democratic county commissioner. So the principle of bridging rural and urban, I agree with, and there are issues that do that. And I think really, if our country is going to get to a better place, CD2 is a model. When I'm down in rural Utah, I come back to Salt Lake and I say to my friends in the city, not all ranchers are the same. You know, not all farmers are the same. I've got a cousin that farms alfalfa in Beaver County. Ranchers know when their water table is low. They know when a mega drought is in the air, and that's true today. Just like I don't think all people in the urban areas are the same. So we should get beyond the stereotypes, and we should really get back to the lost art of listening. And listening is, I think, the most important function that any politician should prioritize. I'll end with a little story about the number of miles our tech director, Ty, and I put in, and our other team members. We put in almost 5,000 miles since I got the nomination. And that's a lot of red dots all across CD2. And in my view, that's political due diligence. So after listening to a lot of people, I heard about the postal concerns with the post offices shutting down last March, last April. It wasn't just in July. And we've been focused on that issue. I heard about water concerns in Calio. I heard about water concerns in King County before King County pulled out of the St. George pipeline. I heard about pollution issues in St. George. Pollution is not just a conversation here in Salt Lake Valley. So if you listen, you learn. And listening tours are easy. And every politician says, I'm going to go on a big listening tour. But what I've been doing with a lot of help from our team is doing an understanding tour. And in fact, we'll be back on the road next week to IPABA, to Dugway, to help inform voters about what's going on out there. And if we're lucky, along the Nevada line, down from Wendover. But it's big, it's beautiful, it's complicated. It's where we as a country, I think, can show whatever the lines are, there are issues that can bridge, there are issues that can bring us together. But 5,000 miles and $1,200 in truck repairs, hopefully will get me a few extra votes from people who didn't expect the Democrat to show up.
That's a good amount of miles on the car, that's for sure.
It's a 17-year-old truck, so it's not a new one. It's showing its age like I am.
That's good. Before we leave your district, the issues that are facing them, I'm curious about the one that is a perennial issue, and it's for the entire state because you just mentioned it, the issue of water. Your thoughts about what's happening there, the pipeline questions that come up, your position on that.
Sure. Mother Nature is determining the reality here. The Bureau of Reclamation just issued a report that said they are predicting Lake Powell water levels to be 10, 15 feet lower over the next 5 to 10 years than they had predicted before. I think that unfortunately these weather patterns, whether it's the fires in Northern California or we've all lived this apocalyptic summer, and even today you look out the window and you think, is fall ever going to arrive? So the reality is that water is not flowing down from the mountains into Lake Powell. So I think I had mentioned before that, you know, our neighboring states, six of our seven neighboring states have basically now gone on the record and said, hey, Utah, hold your horses. Shouldn't you start with conservation first? So one of the issues that I commit to is to listen to all sides. And I've done, I think, a lot of due diligence on the St. George pipeline. But there's a reason why Iron County got out of it. There's a reason why Kane County got out of it. And I think it's probably most wise right now to pause and to really look hard at conservation first and what those water levels really mean, plus the financial costs. You know, I have friends and folks I know down south, and when the numbers are run, how much that pipeline would cost, independent of just the wisdom of the water tables getting lower and lower, I think most people are going to come to the same place that our neighboring states are. That said, if I'm in Congress, you know, everyone always should be in the room. I don't think you should always assume you know what someone's going to say just because they have a certain, you know, title in front of their name.
Okay, let's jump into something that if you're elected, you're going to have to get into almost immediately, and that's the federal government's response to COVID-19, this pandemic. You've had a chance, I know, to review the actions taken by our own delegation in D.C. and what's happening from the administration. Your thoughts about the current approach, the effectiveness or lack of in your mind, and what you think the right approach is as the nation grapples with this very, very difficult disease.
Yes, and I spoke early on about this. We need to lead with science and facts, and unfortunately, that did not happen with this administration. I'll tell you a story. I wrote Chris Stewart as a constituent March 24th, the end of March. I never heard back from him. And I said, you know, is the president right when he says that COVID's going to be basically over by Easter? You know, he seems to be down. I use the word downplaying. And we heard with the Woodward tapes just this week that those are the exact words President Trump used. So I think there's been real political malfeasance at the national level. I'll put Trump and Stewart in the same category. That's led to almost 200,000 lives. Just this week, the president talked about herd. He called it herd mentality, but he meant herd immunity. If you're a voter in Washington County or Davis County or Salt Lake County or Tooele County or Iron County, if you're okay with the president basically saying an approach that may lead to millions of Americans dying is okay, I'm going to fight the opposite. I'm going to say that, for example, Ms. Dunn, our epidemiologist, Mayor Wilson, Mayor Mendenhall, I think they were strong executives. I think our state has gotten some things right, unfortunately, on the financial side, not. But I'll tell you, again, what Iraq taught me is when policymaking is, let's walk it back. When you have a government with Mr. Bannon and people ideologically attacking experts in government, which started day one of this administration, and then a pandemic hits, and on paper, we were supposed to be the most prepared country in the world. We have 4% basically of the world's population, I believe, and we're at 24% of COVID cases. So let's let the data lead, let's let the scientists lead, and let's not kid ourselves that there's been an incredible failure that has led to death. And that's why I'm running. I would never take anything as serious as a pandemic as a political game. And I think, unfortunately, too many parts of our government, especially at the national level, have done that. And they still are playing games with it. You know, they want to distract into lawlessness on the streets. They want to say, you know, a Democrat will take away your police force. I'm not anti-police. What I am is for a functioning government that can meet the next worst pandemic, the next earthquake that's not a 5.7, but that's a 7.1. What I love is I run to challenges. You know, 3 years in Fallujah, I'll tell you, I would wake up with usually mostly bad options. Sometimes there were worse options, but no good options. And I give credit to our local leaders trying to work through the school challenge, because I thought, how would I handle, you know, the school situation if I had a vote or a role? And I think it's tough, and we should sometimes say it's only hard, and it will probably be harder, but do you have competent people in government? Finally, you know, we're almost 4 years into this administration, and I think the report card is pretty clear. You know, we're not year one, we're not year two. And I think people are tired. I think families are tired of being divided. I'm tired of having some friends of mine who voted Trump, who want to, you know, we just need to get to a better place, and I think I can help do that.
Before we get into a couple of great points that you mentioned there, I'd like to know your approach on what the federal government should do, and maybe when what you said is there's just not a lot of great options, you try to provide the best options. When it comes to the economy itself, there have been a couple of relief packages that have come forward here. There are a couple of philosophies on this. You may have your own apart from what I'm going to talk about, but sometimes it's filling a hole, things that have been left as people tried to respond, and sometimes it's about the incentives, about building. Do you have one of those camps? Is there an alternative or a hybrid?
I think there's a hybrid. I mean, the most urgent holes are pretty big right now. I think unemployment is still a big issue. It's less so in Utah. But I'll tell you, I don't like excuse-making politicians when they say, oh, we didn't get a deal. There are a lot of people who are, again, one or two checks away from being booted out of their apartments. I shop at Walmart because I like Walmart. And when I'm walking around downtown, I think these are the constituents, hopefully in the future, who will never write a check. They'll never pick up a phone. But guess what? They look diverse. They look like they're hanging on. They're going to work, not by Zoom. And those are the people I want to fight for as well. So on the federal level, I think the failure of another relief package is the failure of our system. I do think that rebuilding is the better strategy going forward. And I'll tie it back to healthcare. A lot of the anxiety out there is if you lose your job, as millions of Americans have and hundreds of thousands of Utahns have, you lose your health insurance. Are we okay with that? It's not smart policy. There's an economic argument as well, which is we just don't spend our money well. So if I'm hired to represent 700,000 Utahns, I would look for structural changes that would make sure that the safety net is not, again, two threads thick. That's about all it was. And our system was brittle before COVID. And now all the pieces have fallen around us. And I think it does take the federal government to come in and show leadership. One final point. Let's go back to the 2008 mortgage meltdown. When the federal government came in with a lot less money, I think there was a deference in some ways to CEOs and to maybe big corporations to spend the money how they thought it should be spent. I think one of the big lessons this last round, and it was led by Democrats, is to say, you're not going to fire your people. You're not going to do a stock buyback program or CEO compensation before you keep your frontline workers employed. And both parties came to agreement on that. When our country has had its biggest crises, states can't do it on their own. Cities can't do it on their own. So I do favor an additional round that would actually make sure that states and localities are doing okay. And it's not just blue states that are arguing for that. Red states are as well.
Yeah. Part of the approach that you can take and the impact you can have rests on some of these committees that you would like to be part of in Washington, D.C. I'm sure you have thought about this already. Are there some key committees already that you think you would be part of that would benefit the state of Utah?
Yeah, my list is too long. If I went into an R+16 district, they'll give me whatever I want. But the problem is that I'd like to have more than they would ever want to give someone. Okay, I'll give you my top three or four.
Okay, that'd be good.
Former State Department guy, of course, foreign affairs, armed services would be very much in line with my knowledge, my experience. I like to talk about the authorization for the use of military force, which would be another piece of legislation I'd focus on. But I think education and labor would be important. I think those are issues that affect a lot of Utahns. Labor used to have a much bigger role in our state, which I think was a healthier balance than where we are now. I'd also say space, technology, it's NASA. I believe that investing in big ideas and issues that bring us together as human beings is important. Whether you're in Southeast Asia or Europe or South America or Africa or the United States, I'm a believer that NASA is a way that we can get beyond the divisions that seem to be really apparent right now. And the land, of course, if I could, be working on a natural resources committee, that will be an area where I think my diplomatic skills would be well used.
Yeah, sure, a lot of really good opportunities there. Appreciate you going through those and your thoughts about what would be most beneficial for the state. Now, just as we get ready to close, Mr. Weston, you've used the words like hire me for this job, and I know you're looking at it that way because that's what it is the interview we're having. So just take this last minute and a half, make your pitch to the people who will be watching this today and over the coming weeks.
Thank you, Jason, and your whole team for the opportunity. You know, I started by running, 10 months ago by saying our politics are failing our people. That's even more true today, 10 months later, post-COVID and through COVID. And I think it's particularly hurting the most vulnerable among us. COVID is affecting women more. It's affecting minorities more. So if you're worried about your health care, if you're worried about grandpa and grandma not being able to spend time with the grandkids because of this failure on COVID, I'm your candidate. If you're the single working parent who doesn't know, hey, if you lose your job, what are you going to do as far as your health care bills? I'm your candidate. If you're someone who's tired of family reunions being politicized based on national politics, I'm your candidate. I bring, I think, a lot of experience that it's very serious. I'm not someone who's going to go petty. I'm not someone who's going to try and play partisan politics. And that is the difference between me and Mr. Stewart. I would not be running if I thought he had earned the title of representative. I'll let everyone maybe do their own homework on that. I had wanted to start to debate him in every county in June. I wrote a letter saying, let's start in King County. Let's start Kanab. This year is too important to hide from voters, whether me or you. I never heard back, really. He basically didn't respond in any substantive way. I wrote again in August a very serious letter saying, let's do four debates before the Utah Debate Commission. Haven't heard back. So that's, I think, a failure of someone who's been in Washington too long, too disconnected, someone who isn't out on the road putting in 5,000 miles over 5 or 6 weeks. So it is a choice. But rather than go negative, I'm looking to say, here's the positive things that I could help do. And I think I've listed some of those. But our logo, and I'll end with that. If you were to look at our logo, it's two forearms together. And I think where we're at our best as a country and as a state is when we care about our neighbors and when we try to come together on issues that is in all of our interests. And I've tried to identify some of those over the last 10 months. And if you vote for me, I'll work hard. And if I don't deliver, you should fire me in 2 years.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for spending some time with us today. We do appreciate it. This is Kel Weston, candidate for Utah's 2nd Congressional District. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much, Jason, your whole team. And thank you all for listening. And please vote. However you vote, please vote.
That was 2nd Congressional District challenger, Democrat Kel Weston. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. Today, we are airing a conversation with the candidates for Utah's 2nd Congressional District, Democrat Kel Weston and Republican Representative Chris Stewart. Here again is your moderator, Director Jason Perry.
Congressman Stewart, thank you so much for joining us today. Glad to have you with us on our candidate conversations.
Great to be with you. We love the Hinckley Institute. We love the university. Obviously, it's the jewel of the state. And we love the work you're doing. So look, this is public policy. This is informing people. We're glad to be with you.
Well, so glad to have you. And we have a few things to talk about, some things that you're doing in Washington, D.C., some things that you would like to do in the coming term as well. But maybe we can start with just a little bit about you. I know you've been sitting in the seat for a little while. We've got to know you well. But maybe a little bit about you, maybe something we don't know, because we do know you hold a couple speed records. Maybe talk about that.
Yeah. Well, anytime we can talk about flying versus politics, I want to talk about flying, right? So I served for 14 years as a pilot in the Air Force. And Jason, I know you know this. I always wear these. These are my father's Air Force wings from World War II. Kind of a sad story. His house burned down, and these were one of the few things we were able to recover. But he had 6 sons, and 5 of us served in the military. And honestly, if you were to talk to my wife and I, we would both tell you it was some of the happiest times in our life. And part of that was being able to do cool things like go set world speed records. But part of it is, and the far bigger part, was just you know, that feeling of serving our country, that camaraderie, the esprit de corps of serving our nation. And look, I can tell you a little bit more in 30 seconds. Multiple New York Times bestseller, grew up on a farm in Cache Valley, and I love my country, and it's a crazy time in our world right now, and I'm honored to serve.
Yeah, well, we appreciate that too. And you've written 18 books, am I right? Do you have a next one?
Yeah, I've been working on a book for about 5 years now, and my publishers have given up all hope. It's never, but you know, it is 18 or 19 or something like that. But yeah, I am always working. It's something that I enjoy. And I was writing a book on policy, but the problem was, Jason, is the world changed so quickly, I couldn't keep up with it. And I started writing things, you know, hey, this is what the future looks like. And then bang. It happened so quickly, we're a little behind. But I love writing, and I love being able to communicate with people through my writing.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Read several myself. Thank you for that. Can we jump into some legislation? I want to hear some ideas that you have going forward, but a couple pieces of legislation that you have been part of that our students have talked to us about too, particularly when it comes to suicide prevention. Maybe a couple comments, two major bills that you sponsored or co-sponsored dealing with suicide prevention.
Yeah. Well, thanks for asking the question, because it's often overlooked, and this is an important policy. You know, Utah, we have something special here, and, you know, I think those of us who are from Utah, we are very proud of our state, and we should be, you know, and I won't go through the list. I'll let the governor do that, because many of us have heard, but the number one state in the country to do business, number one best managed state. When you look at the future, New York Times did an article recently on the future of economic future. Utah was rated number one. We're proud of that, but there's something about our culture that allows us to be successful in those ways. But I'm telling you, there's some statistics where we're near the top that are shocking, and they're not good news. And a lot of people are really surprised when they hear that we're the fifth highest suicide rate in the country per capita. And again, I tell that to people, and a lot of people are just, you know, they're so surprised, and some of them, frankly, just don't believe it. They're like, no, that can't be. But it's true. And we've got two of our population that are particularly vulnerable. Jason, they're the guys you talked about. They're your students. It's the young people, and it's our veterans. And so one of, I think, the proudest and something I'm very, very happy about, and it took a long time, and that's the National Suicide Prevention Hotline number. Really simple. You know, previous to this, if you're in Salt Lake City and you're in the middle of a mental health crisis, if you were worried about one of your children, your roommate, you know, your brother or sister, and you really didn't know who to turn to, you could call for help, but no one knew what the number was. And if you're in St. George, it was a different number. And if it was a different number, if you're in California or New York. And we realized we needed a three-digit number. 988 is the number. And just like if you have a house fire or if a medical emergency, you call 911. If you're in the middle of a mental health or an emotional crisis, call 988. And you're immediately going to be put in touch with people who will help you. In real severe cases, they will send intervention teams. So this will save thousands of lives. And you mentioned there's other pieces of legislation, and they're kind of subsequent to that. They deal with, you know, further studies and sharing of information. It's that 988 number that I think is the key to this.
Yeah, that's a big piece of legislation. I know that many people are pushing for nationwide. As you look forward to what you would like to do in the next term, what's on your list? Some things that you've been working on maybe, or that you would like to get to?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a couple things. To answer that, I think it's best if I tell you the committees I sit on. One of them is the House Appropriations Committee, which is one of the most powerful committees in Congress. It's been since the 1970s. Since we had someone from Utah on the Appropriations Committee. It's been 50 years. And so when you have worthy projects in Utah, for example, the Central Utah Water Project, or trying to deal with the horse and burro in central and southern Utah, or, you know, if you live in Davis County or Salt Lake County, you may not be aware, but we're starving our horses to death in central Utah because there's too many of them. We need to control their population in the range. If you're talking about, you know, money to ensure Hill Air Force Base, working with Lockheed Martin and others to get the contract for the new ballistic missile upgrade. I mean, my gosh, that's going to be thousands of jobs for Utah here. Those are the kind of things that we'll continue to work on and continue to help. But it's more than that. And look, my job in Congress isn't just to help the state or to bring money to the state. That's not the key. I think it's to make sure the money is spent wisely and to make sure that we realize, hey, you know, we also have an incredible national debt that we're going to have to deal with. And then works with being on the budget committee as well. But the one I want to spend a little more time on is the national security and intelligence work that I do as a member of the House Intelligence Committee. It's a select committee, very small, very powerful, and it's some of the most important work we do. And Jason, if I could elaborate on that, because you said what some of the future things we'd like to do. I really want to work with them. And in fact, we're so close on legislation that I've written regarding FISA reform. To make sure that we don't have situations where you have members of the Department of Justice or the FBI who are violating the privacy and the constitutional civil rights of U.S. citizens by lying to the FISA courts, by abusing their authority before the FISA courts. And there's things that we could do that would, I think, make that much more difficult or much less likely that would happen. And that's one of the things we want to work with on an intelligence side.
On that intelligence committee, I'm curious, because you have an inside look that most don't. There's discussions about the election process and foreign influence in that. Is that real what you're seeing? Is it as active as what you thought it may have been in the past couple of election cycles?
Yeah, it is. And it should trouble every American. I mean, there's good news and bad news. The good news is that we have no evidence at all. I mean, literally none, that any single vote was violated, that any voting machine was ever hacked or broken into. But the interference we're seeing, and it shouldn't surprise anyone, by the way, Russia has been doing this for 50 years to varying degree of success. I mean, in Ukraine, they meddle in their elections to a remarkable degree. They've done so in Eastern Europe and now in other Western European countries, and they'll continue to do so. But so will China. So will Iran. So will North Korea. Anyone who is our adversary, who wants to weaken the U.S., and wants to make it appear to the people of our nation that our own democracy perhaps is failing, they all want to foster that, you know, that doubt. And if you ask who they want to have elected, I don't think that's the right question. I mean, different countries may have different preferences. The intelligence analysis is pretty clear that Russia would like to see Trump. I don't understand that, but that's their thinking. And that China wants to see President Trump defeated. But again, the primary question is why do or how do we stop them from breaking down faith in our democracy? How do we stop them from us mistrusting and being so angry at one another over these elections?
Yeah, very good points. Do you mind if we get to another item that you've been working hard on, but one that we are still trying to grapple with, and that's the impacts of this pandemic? A lot of discussion in Washington, D.C. I know you've been involved in lots of those. Give us a sense, and for those voters that are watching closely, what do you feel like Congress has done well to help with this? Maybe some things that you see coming, particularly as we still see a lot of discussion about different packages maybe coming forward to try to give some relief. What's worked well? Maybe some things you thought have not worked so well, and what's coming?
Yeah. So there's a lot in your question. Let me try and unpack as much as I can. Look, we have experienced unprecedented times. And when I say, Jason, unprecedented, I mean literally. There's never been a time in the history of the world where we took a globally interconnected world and shut it down over a matter of about 2 weeks and left tens of millions of Americans and hundreds of a million of other people around the world without a job, without a way to feed their families. And to give a little perspective on that, when we first started talking about a COVID bill, it was around the 20th of February. And our first proposal was we were debating whether it would be $4 billion or $8 billion. And I remember saying to people, hey, $8 billion is a lot of money. I mean, think what the Department of Justice or Education or the DOD could do with $8 billion. But then we realized, again, the seriousness of it. And 2.5 weeks later, we passed a bill for $2.2 trillion. We went from $4 billion to $2,200 billion in a matter of a few weeks. And that gives you, again, I think, the sense of how quickly this fell upon us and how we realized that this is a very serious situation. And Jason, you just can't discount what it means to have nearly 190,000 Americans now who have lost their lives. And an untold number around the globe. So, you know, that's just a very difficult and personal tragedy for many people. Now, I am hopeful over a number of things. Number one is the Congress came together to put that aid out there. It was bipartisan. It was the House and the Senate. There's only one person who opposed it, and this person opposes everything. And we implemented it very well. I mean, thanks to our bankers, thanks to our community leaders, governors, we actually dispersed an incredible amount of money in a very short period of time that was absolutely necessary. One thing I'm really excited about is Operation Warp Speed, which is we decided in I think it was late March, and this is primarily the president's initiative, but we were going to allocate $10 billion to developing a vaccine, an immunization, which, by the way, that $10 billion is more than the entire rest of the world combined. I mean, this was a serious effort. And the goal, I love this goal, to have 300 million vaccines available the moment the vaccine is okay, the moment it's certified as being safe. And so right now we've got three or four that are in testing, but they're also in manufacturing. So as soon as those vaccines are certified as being safe and effective, we will be able to have 300 million of those available to the country within just a few months, and 100 million of them available initially. So I really think that we've got reason to be optimistic now. Here in Utah, we've done a wonderful job. Look, it hasn't been perfect. It never is, but we're seeing our case, reported cases who are clearly decreasing. We've been below 500 a day for a few weeks now. The death rates are decreasing. I think we have reason to be optimistic as we try to deal with what you said is just a global catastrophe in this pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely right. Do you think there, are you comfortable, you're feeling like what the water is getting to the end of the row? And I'm wondering if you feel like there's going to be more need for incentives, or are we mostly focusing our effort now in Congress on this Operation Warp Speed? It's how to take care of it ultimately.
Yeah, well, Operation Warp Speed is kind of on cruise control, if you will, in the sense that it's already been funded and that's going forward. And that's mostly a private endeavor now. The federal government can't fix this problem by itself. You've got to have local and state and the private sector. But no, I don't think we're quite finished. I do think we need a final bill, but it needs to be very specifically targeted. It needs to target the hospitality industry. Last I talked with executives at Delta, they're still only operating at 17% capacity. The airlines have been decimated by this. If you're a restaurant owner, or if you manage a hotel, I mean, for a while there, our occupancy rates in hotels in Utah was at 7%. And finally, there are still some people who can't return to work. And for those people, I think we need to have extended unemployment benefits. In some cases, it's not because their job isn't available. It's because they are perhaps, more vulnerable. They may have underlying health conditions. They may be older. And, we need not abandon those people. We need to try to help them as well. So I'm very hopeful that we'll have one more final bill that will target the most needy among us. Other than that, Jason, I think our economy is coming back. I mean, it's far exceeded any expectations. 1.3 million jobs added last month. Employment rate down around 9% now, less than 5% in Utah. And again, I'm optimistic that we can continue to get people back to work. But I do think there's one more package the federal government has to do.
Do you see that there is an important role? Because you mentioned a couple times, I've seen it also, for Congress when it comes to how to stimulate the economy. Is that a key function for Congress as you see it? And how do you see your role specifically in it?
Yeah, I mean, it clearly is. And honestly, one of the great benefits that we're seeing as our economy rebounds right now is the effect of previous policies, particularly deregulation and simplifying the ability of business, particularly, again, small business. Look, we've lost the restaurant associations. Someone I spoke with recently told me they think probably 45% of the small restaurants that we've lost in the close down won't ever come back. What could we do to make it simpler and easier for small businesses if they've been impacted by COVID or just generally in the economy? How can we make it easier for small businesses to start a business and to be successful? That's one of the great, and it just clearly is one of the great successes of the last 3 years with President Trump and Republicans' policies, is deregulation and tax simplification. And look, this is not a political opinion. This is just an economic fact. We had one of the strongest economies in my lifetime, and I'm pretty old. We had the lowest unemployment rate ever for African Americans and Hispanic community. We had one of the lowest unemployment rates ever for women. We had, and I love this. I love what I'm about to tell you. The majority of the increase in wages, and that's the key to this, is having people make more money. The majority of that went to the lowest 25% percentile. So we weren't making rich people richer. We were taking some of the hardest working people in America and increasing their wages. And I think those are the things that we've got to continue to do to, as you said, help the economy to grow, because that's the key to our future. Immunizations and other things are very important, but you've got to have that economic kind of economic house in order as well, so that people have jobs mm-hmm. that they can go back to.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn a couple of questions to your district. What are some challenges that you see in your district that you are either have been working on or you intend to address going forward?
Yeah, my district is a bit eclectic in the sense that I represent where you are, downtown Salt Lake City, which I love and I'm so proud of, and the avenues and the university. But then I wrap up here through Davis County and then south all the way to St. George. Well, if you live in very rural Utah, your issues with the federal government are quite different than if you live in Salt Lake City. And so you have to be really versatile and able to deal with both of them. So, for example, let's take Washington County, St. George area. They have a tortoise habitat down there that has huge impacts on their ability to develop and to build homes. They've got the Lake Powell pipeline in the sense that they've got to expand their water supply or they're not going to be able to have any homes or any place to work for their children. They've got a northern corridor where they need to increase their access through building another highway. All of those are deep, deep into federal policy and environmental policy, as I know you know. But they're a little different down there than if I come up here to Davis County. When I come here, it's a little more about, hey, we need help with education, or we need help with affordable housing. You can go to rural Utah and afford to buy a home. Try buying a home in the suburbs around Salt Lake City along the Wasatch Front. That's a huge issue. And once again, I think the federal government can help on that, whether it's trying to reduce the price of timber, which is one of the primary costs that's going up in housing, whether it's, like I said, deregulation that tears down some of the red tape, particularly for low-income housing. And, you talk about some of those things, and that's what's on a lot of people's minds up here in the Wasatch Front.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like this approach the state of Utah has taken to give one representative such huge amounts of ground from the rural to the most populated, is that working well? Do you feel like you're better able to integrate those two interests by making sure you're responsible for both of them?
Yeah, I think in a state like Utah, it has to be that way. I mean, if you were to take, I don't know, maybe New Jersey or a few of the very densely populated eastern states, maybe you could have districts that only focus on the urban centers. But Utah, we have a very concentrated population density here along the Wasatch Front, but the vast majority of the state is very rural. And you just couldn't have a representative district that didn't include some of them. And by the way, you shouldn't. I think that every member of Congress should be compelled and should be conversant in issues, whether it's in the city or whether it's on federal lands or whether it's on private lands, but in the rural part of the state. So I wasn't in politics at the time, but I know when the legislature drew these recent boundaries that they wanted each district to have some populated centers, some of the urban centers, but also some of the rural centers. And I really think that was a good decision. Mm-hmm. Unless, by the way, you wanted to gerrymander a district for one political party. I mean, but that shouldn't be the thing that drives that. I think the more important thing for sure is just to have fair representation and allow us all to represent, diverse interests.
To that really good point, I'm curious about what you are seeing on that political landscape. What you said just makes me think a little bit about what seems to be happening, which is all these very important issues from the pandemic to schools to the economy seems to be forcing people to plant a political flag somewhere, where maybe it seems like maybe their efforts sometimes to come more together, that maybe this seems to be pushing us apart when every single thing becomes a question of your political integrity. Are you seeing that at all, and how are you addressing it?
Oh my gosh, am I seeing that at all? How about I'm seeing it in everything, as you just said. And Jason, look, this is incredibly unfortunate and divisive and unnecessary for our nation. Look, I have a close personal relationship with President Trump. I still see his flaws. I see the things that he could do better. He says things often that I think, I wish he wouldn't have said that. But in some ways, he's a divisive political figure, but he's not the only one. For heaven's sakes, he's been mercilessly attacked from his political rivals from the very first day. And I think all of us need to be willing to say, look, our team, our tribe needs to tone it down a little bit. And, you know, you mentioned the pandemic as being emblematic of that. It's the first time in our history that a pandemic became, or that any health policy like that, such as just protecting lives, became so politicized. And when you put a mask on, I don't think that should be a political statement. I think you just should do it because you want to be careful and gracious and not endanger or make other people feel uncomfortable. That's the reason I wear a mask, is because I don't know if the person next to me is recovering from cancer and whether they have health concerns. And it's just unnecessary. Look, we have some incredibly important issues that we have to work through. They will divide us because there's different views on that. But let's focus on those important things and try to let some of this other stuff go. Every tweet from the president doesn't have to be a national crisis. Every policy that comes out of the White House doesn't have to be debated ad nauseum because some people just don't like the president. And from the Republican side, we can look at some of the ideas that come to us from our Democratic colleagues, and we should be more willing to hear their side and their point of view on that. And last thing I'll say on this, Jason, is look, a lot of us really fear for our future. I can tell you I'm incredibly concerned in some ways. But so were the people in 1860. So were the people in 1824. If you want to read about a divisive election, go read 1824. I mean, it makes today's rhetoric, even today's, look like it's a kindergarten. And the point being, we've been through these kind of tough times, and we figured it out and got through it. And I'm asking people, please don't lose faith in our future. Yeah, it's divisive. In some cases, it's personal. But let's try to put those instances aside and not lose faith that, again, we can work through this, because I'm certain we can.
As we work through these issues, one thing that I have heard a lot lately in the state of Utah is that sort of we punch above our weight class in Washington, D.C. in terms of our representation, but it's also about kind of the Utah approach to politics, the way we approach issues. Is that just a perception we have, or are you seeing that and feeling that in Washington, D.C.?
No, it's absolutely true. And look, I get it. Everyone is proud of their state. They should be. Every representative and senator is proud of their state, and they should be. But there are some states that truly do stand out, and people recognize it. When I tell people around the country, or when they know that I'm from Utah, there is something there that they know, and we discuss it, that Utah seems to have its act together in a lot of ways. And part of it is our culture. You know, you talk about punching above our weight from the delegation. I mean, there's so many examples of that. I talked to you about the committees that I sit on. Very powerful committees, rare for someone to be on them. John Curtis will soon be on Energy and Commerce. Again, one of the most powerful committees. The Chinese Task Force. Oh my gosh, this is one of the most powerful efforts Congress has done in 10 years. Every member of Congress wanted to be a part of that 15-member task force. We had two of us from Utah. John and I were both selected for that. Look at Mike Lee and Senator Romney. They're some of the most well-known senators in the entire country. So Utah does have, I think, a as you said, punching above our weight. We do have much more influence than many other small states or even some large states. And people do seem to recognize that there's something about Utah, and I really believe it's in our culture, where, you know, we're not there just to fight. We're really there to try to do something, to try to solve problems. And I'm really, really happy that that's true.
Yeah, well, there are so many big issues that need to be taken up. When you look at your particular position and your ability to work with this current administration and with the Senate itself, how is that relationship occurring when it comes to Utah and what you see your role as a member of the House working with our two senators?
Well, I'm friends with both of them. And as you know, Senator Romney and Senator Lee kind of come at some problems from a different approach, but not most of them. I mean, I think Mitt is often points out that he votes with the president something like, I don't know, 80 something percent of the time or something like that. And so, and we always have this policy that that our members of our delegation are friends. You know, we would never criticize them. We would allow them to do what they think is right, and we try to do what we think is right, but never criticize any one of us for at times we may disagree, and to try to work together. So, you know, the House and the Senate, honestly, and I don't know if anyone really would disagree with that, there's not much collaboration between them. There's some, but it's not like we all get together and say, okay, here's what we're going to do. It's really the House moving forward and then the Senate moving forward, and then we bring those two efforts together and kind of work them out. But no, it's important for us to have Senator Lee and Senator Romney there. There's a lot of things we couldn't do without them.
Yeah. If you don't mind, we have just about two minutes left, and I would love to have you just make a comment, kind of just make your case a little too. I think we've gone through a lot of really great questions here, but a lot of folks are watching and will be watching this interview going forward. So maybe just take a minute and a half, if you don't mind, Congressman, and tell the voters what distinguishes you and why we should send you back for another term.
Well, okay, now I have a minute, so I'll be brief.
Okay. A minute and a half still.
Well, look, let me first say that it's what an honor it is to serve. And I really mean that. I mean, I didn't think I'd ever find myself in politics. We've discussed my background. It just wasn't something that I thought I would do. But I did it because I felt like our nation is entering such a troubled time, and I thought that I could help. And I really believe that. And what an honor it is. And so, but if you ask why, you know, why me, it's really, I think, comes down to this. Do I represent the district? Do I represent the majority of the district? And do I try to understand those who may be, you know, on the other side of the political aisle, those who don't agree with me, do I try to understand their thinking and try to represent those as best I can? But the ability to go back there and to try to write legislation and see it passed, I think I've proven that I can do that. Not only am I good at it, I'm actually really good at it. And I would just hope that the people in Utah, you know, would understand that and would want me to go back and to continue to represent them. And I hope they will. I ask for their vote very humbly, but I do so. Look, I want to represent you fairly, and thank you for the opportunity.
All right. Thank you for that, Congressman. And thank you for spending a few minutes going through these very important issues.
It's an honor. And again, love the Institute. Love what you guys do. Thank you.
This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.